One of the clearest distinguishing characteristics of the so-called New Atheism is its moral certitude. Richard Dawkins, the late Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, and Samuel Harris have declared that atheism has finally and convincingly won the war against Christian theism. So sure are they of this decisive victory that they have made loud proclamation of that fact and proudly published their summaries of the conflict. Dawkins is the God delusion, Hitchens is God is not great, Harris is the end of faith, and Dennett's breaking the spell all trumpet their perceived triumph. Dr. Annie Bannister, in his new book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, provides a humorous yet serious response to some of the more popular skeptical arguments circulating in the culture. Aimed primarily at skeptics, doubters, and atheists, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist encourages readers to avoid bad arguments and wrestle seriously with some of life's deepest questions.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
Well, the time has come, Morris said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome, listeners. This is Mike Spaulding, your host of Soaring Eagle Radio. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, or, of course, on Facebook and the website www.soaringeagleradio.com. Dr. Andy Bannister is the Canadian director for Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, speaking and teaching regularly throughout Canada, the United States, and Europe. He holds a PhD in Islamic studies. He is an adjunct research fellow at the Center for the Study of Islam and Other Faiths at Melbourne School of Theology. Dr. Bannister is the author of An Oral Formulaic Study of the Quran, a book that reveals many of the ways the Quran was first composed, and Heroes, Five Lessons from Whose Lives We Can Learn, which looks at the lives of five incredible giants of the Christian faith. His latest book, and the subject of our conversation today, is The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, subtitled, Or the Dreadful Consequences of Really Bad Arguments. Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show, Andy.
Mike, it's a pleasure to be on the show. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you're very welcome, and it's my privilege and honor. What drew my attention initially, Andy, to you was seeing that you were involved in Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. I've appreciated that ministry for many, many years, and saw that you were the Canadian director, and so I reached out, I believe it was through LinkedIn, and asked if we could have a conversation on apologetics, and it just so happened that at that time you were finishing up the book that we're going to discuss tonight, and you were very willing to do that, so I appreciate that. But could you tell our listeners a little bit about your work with RZIM in Canada?
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. Very happy to. Many of your listeners have probably heard of Ravi Zacharias. He's been running the ministry now for getting on for 35 years, so pretty sort of established name. But what many people don't always know is that behind Ravi for the last 10 to 15 years, he's been busy building, as he would describe it, a very strong bench. He wants to make sure it's not just him. So there are actually 40 apologists and speakers around the world now that Ravi's raised up and mentored. And so about 5.5 years ago now, Ravi and I had been connected previously, and I was approached and asked if I would come and head up the Canadian office. I was currently in Oxford in the UK, but they relocated me to Toronto, either as a reward or as punishment. I was trying to work out which. And it's a fantastic opportunity to do ministry, because Canada is a very complex country, lots of challenges, lots of opportunities. And basically, at its heart, RZAM is about evangelism, but evangelism aimed very much at the thinking skeptic. So we use apologetics to an evangelistic end. Ravi likes to say that our purpose in life is to help the thinker believe and the believer think. Yes. And so that's what I spend my time doing here in Canada, on university campuses, business settings, on the radio and online, just any opportunity to take the gospel to those who consider themselves thinking skeptics, and try and show them why not merely is the gospel true existentially in terms of what it says about our hearts and our souls, but also that it engages the mind. Love the Lord your God with your heart, soul and mind, said Jesus. And that's what we try to do.
Yes. And you do that through a wide range of medium. Yeah, you already mentioned campus dialogues, debates, videos. There are teaching videos. I've watched a couple of yours myself recently. And so all of that is used, as you said, to challenge thinkers to think through the beliefs that they hold to see if they're consistent, rational, and logic. So I appreciate that, Andy. Your PhD is in Islamic studies. What led you to that focus?
That's right. I often like to joke it was simply that I filled in the university application form wrongly. I'd meant to study archaeology, tick the wrong box.
Yeah.
No, what actually happened, Mike, that was actually all part of the way that the Lord led me into apologetics ministry. In the mid-1990s, back in England, I was actually a youth worker, was a youth pastor doing work for a number of churches. And I often like to say all you need for really successful youth ministry is a Bible and a sharp stick. And then one day, a friend invited me to go up to a place in London called Speaker's Corner. Speaker's Corner is pretty much world famous. It's kind of colloquially known as the World Center of Free Speech. It's a part of one of our big parks in London, where every Sunday afternoon you could stand on a ladder or a soapbox and talk about anything, religion, politics, sport, you name it. And you'll probably get a crowd. Thousands of people go to Speaker's Corner every week to hear the speakers. And my friend had discovered there were many Muslims going to Speaker's Corner, and it was a wonderful way to engage the Muslim community. So he said to me, why don't you come along and try preaching on the street with me, doing some evangelism to Muslims? How hard can it be? I thought to myself.
Yeah.
The answer is very hard. I got up on a ladder and found the Muslims I was speaking to had every objection to Christianity rehearsed. They tore my faith to pieces. I remember getting down from the ladder, my head spinning, thinking, what do I do? And I decided, well, I guess I need to really begin digging into what I've been taught, firstly to ensure my Christian faith is true. I'd never encountered apologetics up until this point. I did very quickly. And then as I began studying, obviously, the Christian faith in more detail, I thought, well, I better start studying Islam better so I can engage my Muslim friends. And literally one thing led to another and another, and ended up with a PhD.
Yeah. Very interesting. Very interesting. So from that, then, is it fair to say, Andy, that maybe a kernel of thought was planted there and began to grow towards a book that would that would help people to answer not just objections, but in the case of your book, really, really bad arguments? Did maybe it start there?
I think it might have done, actually, Mike. That's a good question looking back, because as well as Muslims, I certainly encountered a lot of very vociferous atheists at Speaker's Corner, and many of their arguments were loud. They sounded good, but even back then, I found myself thinking, not sure that actually works.
Yeah.
And then really over kind of 10 years or so of public ministry, I think what's really pushed me to writing The Atheist Who Didn't Exist is exactly that, is encountering, particularly online, but also in the media, lots of atheist arguments that are really just awful ones. And then, of course, we had someone like Richard Dawkins and his book, The God Delusion, which really took that to a whole another level. So I finally got to the stage of saying, what I want to do is write a book that is very respectful to atheism. I hope it comes across in The Atheist Who Didn't Exist that I have a lot of respect for atheist friends who have thought through. I have not a lot of respect for bad arguments. And one of the takeaway messages of the book is, look, if you're going to be an atheist, you know, that's fine. I mean, I'd rather you weren't, but okay, I can respect that. But at least abandon bad arguments. Some of the arguments we hear in the mainstream media for advancing atheism are so bad. They are quite literally ridiculous. Yet they're put out there with a sort of serious-minded face and an Oxford accent, and people take them seriously.
Yes, and I was quite surprised, actually, as I read the book, Andy, to come across, oh, I hear this argument all the time. I hear this advanced all the time. And
oh, yeah.
It really is weak when you begin to look at it and take it apart. So I think you've done a great service for believers who wrestle with, okay, how do I approach these arguments? So one of the things that caught my eye immediately was the book cover. Mm. And I don't know if that was designed deliberately that way, but a pair of spectacles or eyeglasses, and then the last word in the title is, at least to me, is beginning to fade away. Now, before I tell you what I saw in that, I want to know from you, was that intentional?
Well, it's a funny story, actually, right behind that cover. We had another cover entirely planned that I wasn't entirely sure about the more I looked at it, and then I had a graphic designer friend play around with an alternative, which we weren't completely sure about. We took both designs, threw them up on social media, so Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn about a year ago, and asked friends and followers to vote on which they preferred. And most people went for a very early version of the cover that exists now. So we went back to the publisher and their graphic designer and said, right, you know, take this seriously,
yes,
go and give it your best shot. And a brilliant graphic designer, the publisher who published my book in Oxford, went away, had a go, and came up with that cover. And yeah, I'm really glad you like it, because I think he's done a great job.
I
think it's really catchy.
Yeah, yeah. I thought so, too. And I don't know if you've had people interpret it for you, but when I looked at it, I thought, okay, this could be saying a couple of different things. Because one of the things when we talk about apologetics and we talk about worldviews, we say that a worldview is a way of looking at the world. So in essence, it's a pair of spectacles or eyeglasses that helps you to view the world properly. But as I looked at your book cover, I thought, okay, what I'm getting from this is when you look closely at the arguments that atheists advance, they tend to be very weak and disappear. So I don't know how close that is to what your intention was, but
that's a lot of fun, actually. It'd be interesting. Readers can go to listeners can go to theatheistwhodidn'texist.com and see the cover and check it out. There's two things actually was going on. We wanted the word atheist there very prominently, because
yes,
I quite deliberately didn't want the word God, Christianity, or religion, because my primary audience for this, and we may come to this later in our conversation, is actually atheists. Christians are my second audience. Atheists are actually the first audience.
Yes.
I wanted the word atheist very big. And then the our thinking, actually, funnily enough, in the spectacle was the Invisible Man. I don't know if you remember that science fiction story in that movie with the guy with no face and just the glasses. Because one of the ideas I play with in one of the chapters is that one particular argument for atheism, and we may come to this later, actually ironically ends up arguing the atheist who uses it out of existence,
yes,
and they become quite literally the atheist who didn't exist. So we had some fun with that.
Excellent. Well, let's walk through your book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist. Now, Ravi wrote the foreword, and so he set the table by asking two very important questions. One, without God, can we know who we are in essence? And then two, what is the point of life without God? And those are questions that everyone, regardless of faith or no faith, will inevitably be asked, aren't they?
I think so. I think those are very, very primary questions. It's funny that just 3 days' time, I'm doing a big university event about a couple of hours from Toronto, doing a dialogue with one of Canada's most well-known atheists, not a Dawkins type atheist, thankfully. He's much more generous. But we're actually taking the subject of what's the meaning of life? And I find that interesting that he really wanted to talk about that. Now, I don't think without God you can answer that question, but I think everybody asks it. It's a very human question. Why am I here? What's the point of my existence? If I hadn't been born and I hadn't existed, would anyone notice? Would the world be any different? And I think everybody, whatever they believe, asks that question. So it's a great way into the conversation.
It absolutely is. You state your goal. I mentioned Ravi stated these two questions in the introduction, but you state your goal for the book this way, and this is I'm quoting you. Mm. If you come to this book as an atheist, my hope is simply that you will at least commit to being a thought-through atheist, perhaps a doubter rather than a skeptic, somebody who is willing to think deeply and think well. It's been remarked that the difference between a doubter and a skeptic is that a doubter is somebody who hopes there might be an answer. A skeptic hopes that there isn't. Abandoning bad arguments is a great way to begin. Conversely, if you come to this book as a religious believer, my hope is that it will encourage you not to be afraid of some of the atheist sound bites that are frequently hurled like brickbats, and that has to be a UK word.
Yes,
so hurled like brickbats from various directions in our culture. If you can learn to laugh at bad arguments and their flaws, their mystical power evaporates, and you can see them for the paper tigers that they are. I also hope that I might encourage you to see past the ranting of the new atheists to recognize that there are thousands of far more open-minded atheists out there, people who are friendly, good-humored, and open to discussion. What the world needs more than ever is a reasonable dialogue between those who believe in God and those who have questions or doubts. End quote. One of your points is that Christians should not be afraid of conversation with their unbelieving friends. And another point is that when atheism's arguments are cast in the light of reason and logic, they're exposed as weak in the least and downright wrong in many instances. So how can Christians be encouraged by that?
Well, I think that's a great question, Mike. And they can be encouraged in two ways. I think I've been struck by how much fear locks many Christians down from taking evangelism seriously.
Yes.
I first saw that with Muslims. I met many Christians who would be terrified of talking to Muslims, perhaps for fear they're all violent extremists or fear they might cause offense or all kinds of things. But I remember thinking, that's interesting, where that fear, I think, is a weapon of the enemy to stop us engaging in evangelism. Then I began seeing it with atheists, because I think many Christians are afraid of talking to atheist friends for fear that they'll get the full-blown, you know, fire hose of Richard Dawkins turned on them, and that simply isn't the case. And also, I think if it is, there are lots of ways of diffusing it. Yeah. And one of the ways that I hint at a couple of times in the book is just to encourage Christians to just ask questions.
Yeah.
You know, a really good one I teach to Christian audiences all the time is if a friend introduces themselves to you or says to you, "No, I'm an atheist," look them in the eye, smile sweetly, and say, "That's interesting. Atheist tells me what you don't believe. But what do you believe?"
Yeah,
you know, I know you don't believe in. I don't believe in the tooth fairy, but I don't introduce myself as an a tooth fairian. I'm intrigued that, you know, you've used atheist as an identity marker. But tell me what you do believe. What are you passionate about? And then begin to listen, probe, and ask questions. In other words, when Christians and atheists talk, don't fall into the trap of letting your atheist friend ask all the questions and you give all the answers. Make sure for every question they ask, you ask one.
Yes, that's excellent. One of the things that I liked about the book too, Andy, is that you use a lot of humor throughout the book, starting with the chapter titles. I thought they were hilarious, personally. Chapter one is entitled "The Loch Ness Monster's Mustache." Now, I'd never really considered that the Loch Ness Monster had a mustache, but it did give me pause. And so you use that as a launching point, as an illustration of really the point of chapter one is the consequence. Consequences of bad arguments. So your point here is that much of atheism's arguments thrive on poor arguments and cheap sound bites. So you utilized an illustration about a bus billboard popping up in a major city.
That's right. So I mean, one of the things that early on intrigued me and drew me into this was the so-called atheist bus. And it started off in London. It was a bus that a number of atheist groups had come together, sponsored advertisements on the side of London buses, and they read, "There probably isn't a God, so stop worrying and enjoy your life." Yes. And it was known as the atheist bus. And then it turned up in other UK cities, and then it hopped across to North America. So it's been in some American cities, it's been in New York and Washington, a few other places, and then in Canada we've had it in Toronto and Vancouver and all over the place. And I remember, you know, atheist friends getting quite excited about it, like, you know, "We've religious guys, you've had your adverts and now we've got ours."
Yes.
Until I read it and thought, it just doesn't work, you know, on so many levels. It's an appallingly bad argument, embarrassingly so. And as I share in the first chapter, it sort of unravels in quite funny ways, actually. And ends up, yeah, I think has some terrible consequences when you push it to its logical conclusion.
Yes, that's right. That's an example of a bad argument and a misleading soundbite. And one of the things that stuck out for me in that chapter, Andy, is you talked about the soundbite itself. God probably doesn't exist, so just go ahead and enjoy life. Well, what does enjoy mean exactly?
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a couple of things that you can sort of say about the bus ad, but by far, I think the most powerful is the fact that it suggests that, you know, the whole point of life is enjoyment. And that sounds very clever on the side of a bus until you stop and think about it.
Yes.
The point I make in the book is that the only things in life that are designed to be enjoyed and just enjoyed are products.
Yes.
Perhaps a can of soda or a chocolate bar or maybe a new iPhone or something is designed to be enjoyed. But your life is not a product. And life is about far more than just enjoyment. Sure, enjoyment is great, enjoyment is lovely, but it's not the sole purpose of life.
That's right.
And that atheist bus ad is thus deeply, deeply reductionistic.
Yes.
And I think it's really cynical, quite frankly, because what if you're at a point in life where you're not enjoying your life? What if you've lost your job?
Yes.
Or you've suffered a bereavement, or you've just received a terrible health diagnosis from a doctor, or whatever it is. Lots of people are in a place where life isn't very enjoyable, quite frankly. And the subtext of the bus ad is thus, well, if you're not enjoying your life, come on, pull yourself together. It's the whole point of the thing.
Yes.
And I'm just not sure that works in the real world.
Yes, absolutely right. Yeah. In chapter 2, you talk about atheism being a belief system. Now, most atheists will deny that vehemently. They'll argue they argue
I sort of stirred up a firestorm with that one.
Yes. Well, and I think it was good that you put it right up front, very early in the book, so you can get this one out of the way. But they argue, in essence, that not believing in God frees them up from having to provide any reasons or evidence for their lack of faith. But isn't this an attempt by atheists to avoid the intellectual work of defending their position?
Yeah, I think there are two ways of responding to it, Mike. I mean, one is, as you've said, I think for many atheists, it is lazy. I know that term is pejorative, so I use it cautiously. And,
yes.
and I also say it doesn't apply to all atheists. I think some atheists I've met, they've never stopped and thought about it. They've actually never stopped and thought, hang on a minute, there's more to it than this. And of course, then you have the big league atheists like Dawkins and Hitchens and all the rest, advancing this idea isn't. So Christopher Hitchens, I quote him in the chapter, famously said, our belief is not a belief. I think, hang on a minute, Chris, how does that work? I'd love to ask him. Unfortunately, he's not around anymore, so I can't.
Right.
And so really the whole point of that chapter, and I put it early on for a couple of reasons. One was to sort of get it past the filters. But the other, I think, was it's important for the whole discussion, because once you realize that atheism is a belief system, that it's a worldview, and for some, not all, but for some, it has effectively become a de facto religion, then it levels the playing field. I'm not trying to shift the burden of proof or anything like that. Takeaway message in that chapter for people is whatever you believe passionately, whether it's you're a passionate Christian or a passionate atheist, you have to give reasons for that which you're passionate about. Christians have to give reasons? Absolutely we do. Atheists have to give reasons too, because atheism is far more than just the denial of God.
Yes, that's right. And one of the things that I wanted to share with our listeners from that chapter is this whole idea that if atheism is just non-belief in God, then cats, dogs, shoes, cars, and houses are all atheists because they don't believe in God either. Now, just as soon as you bring that up, the atheist is going to protest that and say, but wait a minute, those things can't believe anything. And so what Christians should respond with is something to the effect of this. So now you're saying that atheism is the lack of belief in God by a creature that has the ability to form beliefs. Is that what I'm hearing? And of course, go ahead, Andy.
No, I was going to say, sorry, I thought the pause was for me. No, you're absolutely right. And you just push it back on them.
Yes.
And then, of course, as we say later on in the chapter, the other thing that intrigues me as well, is that if atheism is a non-thing, it's very hard to see how it causes anything.
Yes.
If you drop a hammer on your foot, it hurts. But a non-existent hammer doesn't do anything. Atheism, on the other hand, causes lots of things. It causes many of my atheist friends to attend conventions or to change their social media profile to, you know, something suitably atheistic. It caused Richard Dawkins to write a book, and it caused lots of young, enthusiastic atheists to buy it. And so atheism for a non-belief looks really, really busy, which tells us that it's something. It's very much something.
Yeah. Yeah, even Nietzsche, and you quote him in this chapter, Andy, even he understood the implications of taking that position, because he said, if you remove the foundations of belief in God, you must answer why humans are significant, where ethics, law, morality, and many more ideas come from. So you cannot escape God by merely saying that atheism is not a belief system.
No, and it's interesting. Just this afternoon, I was reading a book where the author put it beautifully. I'd never thought of it quite this way, where he said, you know, it's interesting. If you look at the new atheism, it's a very low-budget form of atheism. The older atheists realized, people like Nietzsche and others, realized there was a cost to atheism. If you're going to be an atheist, there are some costs to pay. You have to give up morality. You have to give up meaning to life. You have to give up purpose and significance and all of these things. And someone like Nietzsche, I think, was willing to pay that. He was willing to say, okay, if that's the consequence, so be it. Yeah. But then, you know, along comes Richard Dawkins and says, no, you can have this, you know, you can deny God and still have rainbows and kittens and morality and everything's wonderful. What's the problem?
Yeah.
And that's a very lazy, low-budget form of atheism. So one of the things I want to encourage atheist readers to do is, look, if they're going to be an atheist, that's fine, but you need to think through what follows from that, and if you're not willing to pay the price, then we need to have a further conversation.
Yes, absolutely. So in chapter 3, you take on the atheist argument that everyone is really an atheist, including Christians, who merely believe in, this is how they phrase it, one God less than atheists do. But this argument goes too far in that it assumes all possible explanations are equally valid. How do Christians answer that one, Andy?
Well, it's interesting. I remember when I first wrote that chapter thinking, you know, that's one of the more obscure arguments. I wonder whether I should include it. But I thought I would. And then I keep running across it. So literally just this morning on my Facebook wall, some enthusiastic young atheist had leapt in. And what was the argument they went for? He said, you know, you Christians reject Zeus for exactly the same reason I reject Yahweh. And I thought, brilliant. Well, not brilliant. Well, there you go. Exactly this chapter.
That's right.
There's a number of issues going on. A lot of atheists, not all again, but many, will follow someone like Dawkins, who popularized this argument, to say, you know, Christians don't believe in Zeus, we don't believe in Wotan or Thor or the flying spaghetti monster or any of these things. Atheists just go one God further. They just include Yahweh in that list that you reject. And so, in other words, we're all atheists, just atheists are more consistent than Christians. And the first time you hear that, that does sound quite scary. I remember the first time I heard it, I thought, oh gosh, that is actually quite clever. How do you respond?
Yes.
Problem is, like all these things, Mike, when you start poking at it, falls apart. It falls apart in two ways very, very quickly. First problem is that it fails to notice that all of those other things I listed are created entities, created beings. If you look what the Greeks believed about Zeus in Greek mythology, he was created. He had a mum and dad.
Yeah.
He was created by the two gods who procreated and had him, the flying spaghetti monster. If such a thing existed, we could investigate his pastery ways using science, because he's made of noodles. There's a physical things. Yahweh, on the other hand, the God of Christianity, the God of the Bible, is not some entity in space and time, but the one who stands behind all space and time, the creator of everything, or to really use the philosophical language, the ground of all being. He is the being who, if he did not exist, nothing else would exist.
That's right.
And that means to compare him to those other entities is a complete false equivalence. It's not even comparing apples and oranges. It's comparing apples and Boeing 747s. It's just not the same category is the first problem. And secondly, and the more easy one to remember for listeners whose heads may be spinning philosophically at this point, is if Dawkins were right, any time where we want to select one option from a range of possibilities, we could be accused of a logical fallacy. The example I use in the book is perhaps a court of law, where perhaps there's been a crime committed and 10 suspects have been brought in, 9 have been eliminated before the police finally find the guilty party, and the guilty party simply looks at the police officer police officer and says, you know, look, you've rejected 9 other suspects. I just encourage you to go 1 suspect more and let me go.
Yes.
The police officer would not say, oh, good point, off you go.
Yes.
What the police officer would say is, well, we've looked at the evidence.
Yes.
And the evidence points to you and not to the 9 others. And
yes.
So the question is, what is the evidence for God? And when we look at the question, not merely is there a God, but what is that God like? I think the evidence for Christianity, the evidence for the God of the Bible, is overwhelmingly, incredibly outstrips the evidence for any other religious option on the table, whether that's the flying spaghetti monster or Allah, the God of Islam, for instance.
Yeah, yeah. One of the most often heard objections, at least in my experience, has been the atheistic claim that believing in God is akin to believing in the tooth fairy or Santa Claus. And in fact, that is the argument that you tackled in chapter 4, the Santa delusion, or why faith in God does not mean that you're insane. So there you take on their critique that belief in God makes you crazy and that you're just believing childhood myths and it's time to grow up and get on with life. So how do you address that?
Well, like, it's, again, it's interesting, isn't it?
You
sort of look at this stuff and you think, who could actually argue that? But the answer is, it's everywhere.
It's very common.
Dawkins makes it. I've seen it on bumper stickers.
Yeah.
I know Christians who get quite afraid by that argument. You know, it sounds very clever. How do you respond? Well, the answer is, it's an appallingly bad argument. It doesn't work for a number of ways. Let me just list 2 of them. The first one I often say to atheist friends is this: you could walk into the university, the library of any major university anywhere in North America or Europe, go to the philosophy section, elbow aside the old bearded gentleman gathered around it, and you could go and look for the discussions about God, and you would find there are hundreds, if not thousands, of serious academic books published on the question of God's existence, both by Christians and by atheists. Philosophers have been debating, you know, the existence of God and what that means and so forth for thousands of years.
Yeah.
I have never yet found the Santa Claus section in any major university library.
That's right.
Now,
That's
that right. doesn't prove that God exists,
right.
but it does prove that philosophers take him very seriously.
Yes.
And in fact, just the other week, I was debating on the radio a very well-known American atheist philosopher. His name is Michael Ruse, a lovely gentleman, very different to Dawkins. And I appreciated at the start of our debate and our interview, he said, I want it to be clear. He said, I think Richard Dawkins is a disaster for atheism. He said, because there's a serious discussion to be had here. And what he said next, I wrote it down. It was fantastic. He said, I believe, as an atheist philosopher, he said, I believe that Christianity is a very serious answer to a very serious question. I happen to believe it's a wrong answer, but it's a very serious answer that can't be dismissed lightly.
Wow.
And I said to him, Michael, thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
That doesn't apply to Father Christmas. And then secondly, Mike, and I think, you know, hugely importantly, I often run this thought experiment, this little experiment when I talk to Christian audiences. I love to say to Christian audiences, you know, put your hand up in this room, in this church, if you became a Christian after the age of about 15.
Mm-hmm.
And usually at least half the hands go up,
yeah.
Perhaps more so in somewhere like Canada that's a little bit more secular than the USA. Over half the hands would go up. I then sort of say, okay, put your hands down. Now, who here came to believe in Father Christmas after the age of 15? Unless there's a comedian in the room,
right.
all the hands stay down.
Yeah.
And it makes the point. Adults become convinced of the reality of Christianity.
Yes.
People convert from atheism to Christianity after having carefully investigated the evidence. Santa Claus gets left behind in childhood. Many people, in fact, probably more than half the Christians in most churches, have discovered God as adults. God and Father Christmas are utterly different.
Yes, that's a powerful, powerful illustration, Andy. One of the darker aspects of this particular argument, and one that I spent some time chewing on, trying to understand. Okay, how are we going to address this and tie this in, is this idea that because God is this myth that people are hanging on to into adulthood, and then they become parents and they begin to raise their children, they are teaching their children these myths. And it has it's been stated by Dawkins and others that something should be done about that to stop that. that causes some concern for me.
It does, and obviously I deal with that in the book. It causes concern for me in a couple of ways. One is it's wrong-headed. Worrying about parents raising their children as Christians is only a problem if Christianity is false. Christianity is false, then actually, yeah, there is a concern there. Of course, if Christianity is true and atheism is false, perhaps we as Christians should be worried about atheist parents raising their children as atheists. See, that argument cuts both ways. The other deeper problem, though, is this. I think Dawkins at times comes worryingly close for me to sort of a fairly totalitarian position, because really the idea that he's playing with is that parents shouldn't be allowed to teach their children what they dearly believe and hold to be true. That some authorities, what the state maybe, a committee of scientists, I don't know, should be screening what parents taught. And I say in the book, you know, the more I read that kind of language, it reminds me of something. You know, I spend a lot of my my late 20s and early 30s doing a lot of teaching in Eastern Europe, which had been, you know, badly damaged, of course, under the communist era and until freedom came in 1989 with the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I regularly meet people who would tell me stories that would go this way. They would describe how when they were younger, you know, they were actually barred or banned from education. And you'd ask why, and they'd say, well, because my parents were Christians. And what the communists would do is, if your parents were Christians, they would say to the family, very straightforward, you either abandon Christianity and become an atheist, or your kids are not getting schooling.
Yeah.
And that sounds very worryingly close to some of the rhetoric of the new atheists. Yes. I'd prefer to say that everybody raises their children in such a way as to try and convey to their kids what they believe to be true. And yeah, okay, we need to be careful about the lunatic fringe, but you know what? We have the lunatic fringe in Christianity, we have it in atheism too.
Let's
be consistent.
Yes.
And then recognize that children are then going to grow up and decide what they hold to be true for themselves.
Yeah.
Children grow up and leave the Christian faith, children grow up and leave atheism.
Yes.
So I think Dawkins is playing a very dangerous rhetorical game.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Thank you for that answer. Chapter 5 is probably, for our listeners, the most often heard bad argument, and that is the Christianity is a crutch argument.
Mm, yeah.
Why is that one of the weakest?
It's funny, isn't it? Why is it weak and it's a crutch?
There's a
joke right there, isn't there?
That's
right. Yeah, we hear that very, very commonly. I think it's very common because it sounds very compelling, firstly, to go, oh, yeah, you just believe that because it's a crutch. I think also it allows the atheist to sort of sound well-meaning, you know, and we push it too far, it's condescending, but, you know, you poor religious type, obviously, you know, you're weak, you're inferior, there's something not quite right with you emotionally, and so it's understandable why somebody, you know, who as pathetic an example of humanity as you would want to lean on the idea of God, because you can't cope with the idea that the universe is empty and dark and cold and alone, and so you've invented God to assuage your fears, perhaps your fears about death or the afterlife or whatever. That's the way the argument goes. Like all of these things, it sounds very clever, it sounds very sophisticated, especially if there's a British accent involved. But the problem is it's wrong on a whole number of levels. One of the biggest problems, of course, with it is it pings back on atheism quite nicely. If any listener hears it, the first thing you can do is look at the atheist you're talking to and say, well, you know what, if there is no God, then you're right. I guess I am deluded, and perhaps the reason I've invented God is for the reasons you describe. That's actually possibly true. However, if there is a God, then of course it is you, my atheist friend, who is deluded.
Yes.
And maybe you've written God out, not because you've investigated the arguments, but because you want to live a life entirely free of moral responsibility. You don't like the idea of a judgment and being held to account. You want to live your life entirely as you like. And so you've written God out of the picture, not because of the evidence, but because of psychology. See, it works both ways.
Yes.
And the big idea underneath that, Mike, is that psychology cannot tell us whether something is true or not. You know, there are many things that I feel good about. You know, I like the idea of mountain walks. I like the idea of chocolate. I like the idea of ice cream. I like the idea of miniature roller skating pygmy elephants. All of those things make me feel quite happy thinking about them. Thing is, three of them exist and one of them doesn't. And simply by looking at my emotional response, you can't tell which is true. You'd have to investigate the evidence and you'll discover the first three things exist. And unfortunately, we don't yet have miniature roller skating elephants. How we feel about something doesn't tell us whether it's true.
That's right. Yeah. And many atheists, and you certainly have an abundance of quotes where atheists are honest and they give some very candid answers. about Christianity and about belief in God, and for many of them, it boils down to this: they just don't want there to be a God.
Yeah, I think that's hugely important. I'm very careful not to push that too far because I don't want to be guilty of doing to my atheist friends what Richard Dawkins tries to do to us. But I think we can at least raise the question. And I think the one that I found the most intriguing, I discovered it researching the book, actually. I knew some of the others, but I came across that quote on page 90 from Aldous Huxley, yes, the famous British atheist, and where he says, I'll just read the quote, actually, because I think it's so powerful.
Yeah.
He says, "For myself, as for most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness, so of atheism, was an instrument of liberation. The liberation we desired was liberation from a certain political and economic system and liberation from a certain kind of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom." And then he goes on to say the best way of dealing with that was to deny that the world had any meaning. In other words, he says we wanted to be sexually free, to sleep with whoever we wanted, whenever we wanted. We realized that if Christianity was true, it wouldn't let us do that, so we just denied Christianity.
Yeah,
and it's a very powerful quotation. I appreciate the honesty,
yeah,
and I'm not saying again every atheist is in that position, but I think many are, many are. And a really interesting way I found over the years of exploring that is if you're a Christian talking to an atheist friend, ask your atheist friend, you know, what do you think would happen if you were to become a Christian tomorrow? Let's imagine over the next half an hour in our conversation, I convince you that Jesus is the Son of God, died for your sins, rose from the dead, and you decide, gosh, I've got to become a Christian, and you know, bow the knee and you become one. What would happen next? And if the answer is something like, well, I guess life become really boring, now you're onto something, because you're into this area. I think many people reject Christianity, not because they don't believe it's true, because they're afraid if they become Christians, life will become boring, their choices will become restricted, and all of these things. And that's not a logical argument, that's an emotional argument.
Yes, bingo, yeah. One attack on Christianity that has stood the test of time is that it poisons everything. Chapter 6 takes on the air, often heard in statements like, well, most of the wars in history have been caused by religion. Now, this is quickly dispatched as erroneous. How do you do that?
Well, I think a couple of things. I mean, obviously, you know, when you actually study history, it becomes quite interesting, because that idea that most wars are caused by religion. There's a fantastic book that I came across during the research for the book called The Encyclopedia of Wars, and written by a sort of academic who obviously needs to get out more, because it's a great big fat 3-volume thing where he basically goes through the whole of recorded history and discusses each war that we know about. And what's interesting is that between 8000 BC and AD 2003, he lists 1763 wars, which tells you something about the human condition, but there we are.
Yes.
But he categorizes them. The editors categorize them as what the cause was. And of those, only 123 are characterized as religious. So that's less than 7%. In 10,000 years of history. So 93% have entirely other causes. So it's not to say that religion can't be an issue. I think we need to be realistic in that. When religion goes wrong, it can go badly wrong. But the idea that it's the main cause, and the other thing I say in that chapter that I remember when this first struck me, I sort of thought this is really interesting, is that idea that religion poisons everything. That was actually Christopher Hitchens coined that particular phrase in his book God Is Not Great. The problem I have with it, Mike, is it doesn't go far enough.
Yeah.
By which I mean you could take the word religion out of that sentence and insert other words. I mean, government poisons everything. Look at the damage that government has done. Or money. Money causes greed and jealousy. Sex causes all kinds of problems when it goes wrong. So sex poisons everything.
Yes.
Science poisons everything. Look at the environmental damage that's being caused by certain scientific inventions. And so the list goes on. And the more you do that, the more you realize something with horror. You realize the problem is not science or sex or money or politics or religion. The problem is somewhere closer to home. The problem is us.
Yes.
Human beings have this ability to pick things up, science, religion, whatever it is, and use things for good or evil. And we can use things for great good, use things for great damage. And so that very atheist soundbite gets right to the heart of the gospel. Because of course, as Christians, we'd say there is something wrong with us. That's the message of Jesus, that we are broken and twisted, and we need not just more, we don't need religion as the last thing we need. What we need is new creation. There's only one worldview that offers us that.
Amen. Yeah, that's right. Chapter 7 was perhaps my favorite chapter because it covers the bad argument that science explains everything. Why is this perhaps the easiest bad argument to refute, Andy?
Well, it's one of the most common ones, isn't it? Isn't it, Mike? But one can refute it in so many ways. One of the problems with the idea that science explains everything, and sometimes when I say that, when I use this argument on university campuses, I will regularly have people say, "Nobody really believes that," and I'll go, "Oh yeah," and I'll wheel out a few atheist quotes out of the closet. The basic problem with it is that it's so self-evidently, obviously false. I mean, firstly, when someone says to you, science can explain everything, you can look them in the eye and say, well, can you prove to me using science that what you just said is true? And it can't, it's self-refuting.
Yeah.
But the other is, and I, you know, engage in that little thought experiment at the start of the book, take any kind of question that lies outside science. You know, one of the example I open the book with is if we were in the Louvre, that very famous art gallery in France, in Paris, and I was to show you that the picture of the Mona Lisa as painted by Leonardo da Vinci, one of the most famous paintings in the world, and I was to say to you, Mike, I've always wondered, why did Leonardo paint the picture that way? She's got a very strange facial expression. You know, why did Leonardo do that? And you go, well, actually, I'm glad you asked that, Andy. What I plan to do is, once the museum's closed, I'm going to hide behind that pot plant over there, you know, wait until the museum's closed, and then I'm going to sneak out, I'm going to hack the painting to pieces, you know, get a sample of the paint, get a sample of the wood frame that the painting's painted on. I'm going to take those off to my chemistry lab back in the USA, and I'm going to analyze the paint, analyze the wood, and do all these clever experiments, and I'll be able to tell you why Leonardo painted the picture that way. I would look at you and go, Mike, you know, you're insane, you're a lunatic in the Louvre. It doesn't matter how many of those types of experiments you do, you can't answer the question, why did Leonardo paint the picture that way, is a question of art history. We can answer it, but we can't answer it using physics, chemistry, or biology. We need art history, and there are many, many questions like that, including some of the most deep questions about the human condition. Now, what is the value of a human life? What is right and wrong in certain situations? What is the point of life? Why are we here? Is there a God? All those kinds of questions. Science can't answer those questions. And that's not to attack science, it's to recognize that science is a tool, and most tools have a limited range of uses. Hammer is great for whacking in nails. Don't try and do brain surgery with it.
That's right. Science as the only reliable way to uncover truth is just demonstrably false. There are other means of acquiring knowledge. So chapter 8 then takes us to Humpty Dumpty and the Vegan. That covers the subject of morals. Now, I like talking about this with unbelievers because it is an area that causes, it's always been my experience, it's an area that causes them to think. Now, Sam Harris, in his book, The Moral Landscape, How Science Can Determine Human Values, tries to answer the what is good question, but he fails miserably. So why can't science explain morals?
I think for a number of reasons, Mike. I think, again, it's a misuse of science. I think science can tell us how to do something. Science can't necessarily tell us whether we should do it. I think it's in that chapter or the previous chapter, certainly, that I use the example of a gentleman called Louis Pfizer, and well-known scientist, probably one of the most famous chemists of the 20th century. And he's an interesting case in point. He made an amazing scientific discovery. He discovered the way to, we could artificially synthesize vitamin K, which is used in blood coagulation. That discovery of Lewis and his team saved the life of maybe hundreds of thousands of people since he'd made that discovery. Amazingly good use of science, okay?
Yeah.
Well, he also discovered something else. In the 1950s, the U.S. Army approached Lewis and his team at Harvard and asked if he could help them develop a weapon that could be used for clearing tracts of jungle in a military campaign. So at this point, there was a lot of fighting going on at the end of the Second World War out in Japan, and they needed a weapon that could sort of flush people out of jungle settings. And so Lewis and his team invented napalm, that gel that sticks to human flesh when it burns. Now, at the end of World War II, thousands of tons of that were dropped on Tokyo, killing and burning to death, in fact, hundreds of thousands of civilians. Now, maybe you can justify that. World War II, we needed to end the war. Okay, but now look at Vietnam and the incredible damage and pain that was wreaked by that invention.
Yeah.
And that illustrates the problem. Science gave us vitamin K coagulation. Science, from the same person, gave us napalm. Science can't tell us which of those inventions is good or bad, or even which use of them is good or bad. For that, we need other tools.
Yes.
And so science actually raises moral questions. Every time there's a new scientific discovery, it actually generates moral questions. How should we use this technology we've invented? It can't answer moral questions.
Yes, yes. And for the atheists, in most instances, Andy, is it fair to say that their definition of good essentially boils down to personal happiness?
For many, I think it boils down that way. I think it certainly boils down to personal preference is where you end up. And I talk in the book, one of the most helpful atheist writers on this, who I quote in the book so listeners can go and follow this up. There's a gentleman called, there's an atheist called Arthur Leth, taught at Yale for many years until he died tragically young in the late 1970s. And he wrote a very, very famous paper. It's available online. You can read it for free. And he's an atheist, as I say. And he argues in that paper he wrote that when anybody tells you to do anything, when anyone makes a moral claim, you should do this or you should do the other, so basically they're making an authority claim. They're telling you should do something. But the problem is, to any authority claim, he says you can behave like the school bully or the town drunk. You can look at the person making it and say, yeah, says who? And in the absence of God, he says, there are only two ways we can conceive of authority. We either give every individual person the ability to make up good and evil for themselves. But what happens if we clash? You know, you decide it's good to help old ladies across the road, Mike. I decide it's good to steal their purses and run off with their money. Who decides? Or, said Arthur, you allow the state to decide, and you just let the state make up good and evil. But it doesn't matter. Whichever way you go, when anyone tells you to do anything, you look them in the eye and you say, yeah, says who? And he says the problem for the atheist, and he is one, is that morality just is shipwrecked on the grand says who problem, unless there is some kind of transcendent being bigger than us, outside of us, who can ground morality, he says, then basically morality is dead in the water.
Yes, yes. Chapter 9 tackles perhaps the most important question facing anyone, which is the meaning of life. Chapter 9, you entitled The Peculiar Case of the Postmodern Penguin. I just love these titles. Or Why Life Without God is Meaningless. And of course, you tie these illustrations in, but the answer to that question, what is the meaning of life, is going to shape every aspect of your life, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think it is the most important question, which is why I sort of use it to begin orientating the book towards the end. You know, from we slowly move from dealing with bad arguments to beginning to hint at perhaps a Christian response. And I agree. I think that what you determine the meaning of life is going to affect your hopes and your dreams and your ambitions and how you spend your time and your money and absolutely everything else. It's absolutely central. But as I hope I show in that chapter, the problem is that if you're an atheist and you disbelieve in God, there can be no meaning to life. We really are just a cosmic accident. We're the result of time plus chance plus natural selection. And we might be very complex, we might be very sophisticated, all of those things may hold true, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But the one thing we don't have is purpose. There is no reason for our being here. Life has no purpose, no goal, no meaning.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the things that you pointed out in this chapter, Andy, is and you quoted, I believe it was Ray Baumeister. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, and he suggested that if we're really going to answer this question of life's meaning, if we're going to answer it adequately, then there has to be answers to at least four underlying questions. And I'm going to just give these briefly, and then you can comment. But first of all, we're going to answer the question of identity. Who am I? We're going to answer the question of value. Do I matter? We're going to answer the question of purpose. Why am I here? And then you're going to answer the question of agency. Can I, individually, make a difference? Christianity answers all those questions best.
Yeah, I think so. I think the reason I used Roy's work in the book is often we talk about the meaning of life. It can get a bit vague and a bit nebulous. You know, what do we actually mean?
Yeah.
And what I find his work so helpful is to break it down, and to just sort of, you know, play with a couple of his categories. You know, the point is, if life has some kind of purpose, then we can talk usefully about meaning. Of course, if life has some kind of purpose, we can also talk about value, and we can also talk about goodness as well flows from that. The example I often use is its purpose that enables us to determine whether something is good or bad. If I try and hammer in a nail with my watch and it breaks, and I say, oh, it's a bad watch, you'd look at me and go, no, it's not, Andy, you've just misunderstood its purpose. Mm. I need to know its purpose and know whether it's performing that purpose well. And if we want to talk about a life well lived or a good life or any of this kind of language, we need to answer that purpose question. And then, as I say, the things like the agency question, the ability to make a difference, that is such a primary question for many people. Most of us, I think, deep down want to know that our life has made a difference, that the fact that we've been here for, you know, 70, 80 years, whatever the length of our lifespan turns out to be, that it's actually made a difference. And tragically, if atheism is true, it hasn't. It makes absolutely no difference because the outcome is the same. Eventually, the human race will expire. Eventually, the sun will expand and swallow the earth. Eventually, the universe will come to an end, empty and cold and dark and alone. It makes no difference what you do now. Christianity, on the other hand, says it matters profoundly because you're not just a cosmic accident. You're not just some cog in the cosmic machine. But the very hairs of your head are numbered. When God created you, Mike, he had you in mind and nobody else. There is a role in God's plan that only you can fulfill and nobody else. And, of course, you know, Jesus invests human life with huge value when he dies for us on the cross. That shows how significant each one of us is, that God would pay so high a price.
That's right. Atheists claim that beliefs, decisions, choices, they must rest solely on reason and evidence, but then they demonstrate faith in decisions that they make every day, and that is the subject of chapter 10.
That's right. Yeah, so in chapter 10, I know we're running out of time, so we'll be quick, but in chapter 10, the big idea I'm playing with is that I think a lot of atheists get nervous about the word faith, or they play off against the word reason. You know, atheists have reason, you Christians have faith, reason is superior, ha ha ha. So goes the argument. And what I seek to show in that chapter is that everybody has faith. Because when you look at what the word faith means, faith is really a translation of the Latin term fides, which means trust. When you have faith in something, it means you trust it. And that's not contrary to reasons, it's what takes the reasons and goes further. So I've been married for 17 years. You know, before I asked my wife to marry me, I knew all kinds of information about her. I knew facts. But there came a point where I had to go, okay, I know the facts, but now I need to ask myself a question. Am I willing to put my trust in this person and marry her? And that's really how the Bible talks about faith in God, funnily enough. The Bible is not interested in us just believing in God. I find, you know, the book of James says, you know, even the demons believe in God tremble.
Yeah.
What God is looking for is us to do is exercise trust in him. In fact, the biblical story is really, this is who God is. This is his character. This is what he's done in history and supremely in Jesus Christ. Now, on that basis, will you put your trust in him? And I point out, atheists do this all the time. We have to, as human beings, put our trust in things, whether it's trust in the laws of physics or trust in the pilot who's flying us on the aeroplane or so on and so forth. In fact, it's actually amusing and ironic that atheists would tell us they have confidence in their position, but the word confidence comes from a Latin word, con with fides, faith.
Yes.
And so an atheist says, I am confident, you go, fantastic, you have faith too.
That's right, yeah. So you tie it all together then, Andy, in chapter 11, where you tackle this, it still surprises me to this day that the argument persists, that Jesus was a myth. He was a made-up historical figure. There's no evidence for his existence whatsoever. That's just simply nonsense.
Yeah, it is perhaps in one sense the most appallingly bad argument of all the ones I deal with in the book. It's so bad you kind of wonder where it's come from. Yeah. And actually, what's interesting when you start asking that question, I think you get your answer. One of the people I quote in that chapter. There's a gentleman called Bart Ehrman, who is a former Christian, now, well, I think an agnostic. I think he hasn't quite come out and identified as an atheist, but has written lots of books attacking Christianity and so on and so forth. But I quote him, because he began to run into this argument so often from atheists that Jesus didn't exist, that he felt the need to write a book called Did Jesus Exist? And he answers the question in the affirmative as a skeptic. And then he goes on to say, he said, in fact, the evidence for Jesus' existence is so strong that the only reason anyone would deny it is for ideological reasons. And that's what you're forced to conclude, I think, with people like Dawkins, who plays with this. It's simply an ideology driving it. It's not based on evidence. And my most, the thing that intrigues me the most, I think that my favorite quote of the entire book that I managed to draw out of Dawkins is, of course, Dawkins wants to say that Christians are deluded for believing in God. But then when confronted with the evidence that Jesus believed he was God, Dawkins says, well, maybe Jesus was merely mistaken. And I want to go, hang on a minute. So Christians are deluded for believing in God, but Jesus was merely mistaken for thinking he was God.
Yes.
And that's such a crashing contradiction that you're left concluding, I think Richard is just doing his very best not to face up to Jesus. Yes. It's one thing to play around with arguments. It's one thing to argue with the idea of perhaps a God who's distant and the God who set the universe in motion, who's out there somewhere. But the God we see revealed in Jesus Christ, that's a different matter entirely. That's a God not merely trying to get, you know, a foot in the door. That's a God who's already in the door, pulled up a chair next to the fire, made himself a cup of tea, and now is looking at you saying, right, Richard, now we need to talk about your life. It's too uncomfortably close. Yeah. And I think the best way to demolish that kind of Jesus is to deny he ever existed. But of course, historically, it's ludicrous. The evidence for his existence is tremendous.
Yes, and I want to wrap up our time together, Andy, by quoting you. This was one of the quotes that I thought was very good, from page 219 on your book. And this is a quote: "Once you are willing uncritically to believe things contrary to the vast weight of evidence, even to the extent of entirely ignoring the key scholars in a given field, well, at that point, all checks and balances are gone. Your theory has achieved escape velocity and is now free to orbit wildly in the outer darkness beyond the gravitational pull of reason and evidence," end quote. Fabulous quote, Andy. I thought that was a great way to pull all of the material together. Any new projects on the horizon for you?
Yeah, so I'm sort of fairly snowed under promoting this book. My goal is, as I think I said at the start of the interview, is to get this into the hands of as many atheists as possible. So we're doing lots of radio and media pieces, not just Christian, but mainstream as well. So certainly for listeners who are Christian to this, I'd encourage prayers for that. Then we got a busy speaking tour, and I got some very exciting university engagements across Canada coming up. And then the next project is I'm just beginning work on my next book, which is going to be exploring the whole area of digital culture. You know, we live in this 24/7 always connected, always on media age, and I'm beginning to be intrigued. That raises all kinds of apologetic questions. I regularly meet non-Christians who are, you know, admit to me that they're struggling with their email and can't escape Google and all this stuff. But I think through that struggle, I think that raises all kinds of questions about what the purpose of life should be like, you know, what rest really looks like. And Jesus says, you know, come to me all who are weary and I'll give you rest. So yeah, similar, in one sense, playing a similar game to The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, which is taking some common cultural discussions and perhaps trying to connect them to the gospel in ways that people wouldn't normally think of.
Well, that's exciting. I can't wait to read that one. So where can listeners find you? Social media, website?
Yeah, so the best place to find me on the web is several websites, but the easiest one is theatheistwhodidn'texist.com, no apostrophe in the URL, theatheistwhodidn'exist.com, and listeners can download a free copy of Chapter 1, find out lots about the book, and there are links to get hold of it. And for people who are on social media, Twitter or Facebook, they can find me by searching for Andy G. Bannister. Andy Bannister had already gone by the time I got on social media, so I had to use my middle initial. So Andy G. Bannister. I'm pretty active on Twitter, pretty active on Facebook, so people can come and say nice things about the book or insult me there, and I'll engage with them.
Andy, I've enjoyed our conversation and look forward to the next one. Thank you for being on Soaring Eagle Radio.
It's been wonderful. Thanks for the opportunity, Mike.
Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. Visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, Pastor Mike at woh.rr.com.